The old man stares, terror flickering in clouded eyes. I'm not... He wheezes. Not done yet. He fixes on Marsden, grips the younger man's sweater. Bear, you're okay, Marsden says, hiding his fright. Something is amiss. Let's just rest. We pushed this too far. Bear reclines on his side. His jaw closes, opens like a beached fish. His eyes are fading. Bear? In panic, Marsden rolls the man onto his back, rests his ear to Bear's mouth. No warm exhalations. Nothing. Bear? Bear? Bear! Marsden learned CPR years before, but struggles to recall the rules, seeing only scenes from television melodrama. He locks his elbows, attempts a few chest compressions. He pinches the old man's nostrils, blows into his mouth. In desperation, he jams down harder on Bear's chest, causing a sinister crack. But a flicker of the eyelids, the focus returning momentarily to his gaze. That did something, Marsden blurts. He resumes more vigorously, checking between sets whether Bear's breathing has resumed, studying the man's thin, dry lips, a mouth that charmed sitters and enraged Pablo Picasso, that illuminated daughters and destroyed sons. Marsden blows a few more breaths, does more chest compressions. The old man blinks again. Yet whenever Marsden pauses for too long, life seeps from Bear's eyes. Marsden shouts into the forest for help. What if he runs for assistance right now? He can't take the path they came by. There'd be 10 minutes of descent, then finding the mobile phone in the cottage, waiting for an ambulance, pointing the paramedics back here. No, he must take the direct route, forging right down the mountainside. He'll reach the cottage in around a minute, phone for help, sprint right back up, resume CPR. That could work. And Marsden cannot let his friend lose his father after that last exchange. They can still mend this. He notes a gap between two pine trees. There's a final set of compressions. Again, the old man animates slightly. Marsden leaps up, dizzy for an instant, and he bolts towards the branches, vaulting over the path's edge. Too late, he sees. A ski slope gradient plunges beneath, trees hurtling at him. He turns his shoulder, slams into a trunk, bangs past it, grabbing for anything, hands spiked by pine needles. He's picking up speed, grasping for any low foliage, and he snags a branch. The canopy swings overhead. He is hyperventilating, needing to vomit. Treetops drop away below him. There's no way back from this. The tighter he grips, the weaker his sweaty grasp seems, his legs kicking for any solid earth. Whenever a boot tip hits mud, it immediately gives way. The branch he clutches quavers with his body, drops of melted snow pelting down. I'm about to die. He kicks out again, seeking anything firm. One boot tip bashes near vertical mud, but if he lets go of the branch and tries to scramble upward, will his footing give way? The only chance is to launch in the direction of that foothold and pray that momentum flings his other leg forward, ramming it into the incline. If he hits a root, even a wet leaf, he'll slide down, somersaulting backwards, spine snapping, skull cracked, lying in the cold, wet forest, half alive, devoured. Erase that image. But he can't. Birds feasting on his brain. He plots and replots, palms losing grip. Go! But he can't. Just go. His shin bangs into a rock. Fingers claw the hillside dirt, and his thighs spasm. And somehow, he's there, on his knees, on flat earth, precisely where he was 3 minutes earlier. Trembling, he crawls over to Bear, puffs another few lungfuls into the man, compresses his chest. Again, life flickers in the painter's eyes. Marsden wipes the sweat from his face and rests his hand against Bear's hip, taking a shivery breath. Whereupon, he feels something under his fingers. A plastic antenna juts from the jeans pocket. It's the mobile phone. Bear had it this whole time. That must have been why he was running away, to call the police on Charles. Marsden battles to awaken the digital screen. Finally, the Nokia theme and a signal. Frantically, he opens the contact list, which contains only two entries, Charles and police. His brain stalls, staring at grey digits. Bear gasps, eyes desperate. His knobbly hand, which moved colours, which moved people, clutches a leaf. Marsden looks at the phone again, and he stands. He glances down at the man, then back at the screen. No, he mutters, then underhands the Nokia over the path's edge, into the void. The phone flips. It's lost from sight. After a few seconds, a distant pop. Enough, Marsden says, crouching beside Bear Bavinsky, his knuckles resting soothingly against the painter's bearded cheek. Enough of this life. It's enough. 60. Pinch sits in the supermarket car park, fogged from alcohol still, considering driving directly to the airport. But he must face what's happening. He starts the engine, turns back towards the cottage. When he arrives, he waits in the parked vehicle, braced for his father's wrath. Yet he hears nothing. He gets out and perceives movement at the edge of the forest. Marsden, covered in mud, walking closer. Hey! Pinch calls out. Where's Dad? Marsden shakes his head, saying something about Bear collapsing, that nothing worked. Pinch can't make sense of it. But where is Dad right now? Marsden's response bounces off him. Pinch stands there, uncomprehending, saying, We need to get help. He hunts in the cottage for the mobile phone. Have you seen it? I don't know. Charles, honestly, it's too late. A neighbor calls the emergency number on their behalf. When the paramedics arrive, a flurry of French conversation ensues. An ambulance in the driveway, a few nosy locals peeking around. Loud voices sound from up the path, men carrying down the body. Pinch glimpses his father on a stretcher. The last sighting. Marsden drives Pinch into town to deal with paperwork. Afterwards, they hardly speak, hardly eat. Nothing seems appropriate. 2 days later, Marsden leaves. It's Pinch alone on the property. He awakens under his father's duvet, looks around the stone walls of the cottage, imagining this place before electricity came, back when the late Cecil Ditchley lived here, forced to walk an hour to the village for bread and meat, reading by candlelight, throwing pots on his kick wheel. Pinch finds his father's glasses, still on the kitchen table, and throws them away. He unlocks Bear's studio, free to do so now, and surveys a cityscape of old brushes, its cemetery of mangled paint tubes. Dad, in his inventory, turned around every canvas, thighs, shoulders, throats. In the end, what did Bear think of all his paintings? Pinch locks up and walks towards the woods, taking Marsden's stairs up the hillside, following the same muddy path where his father died. He steps over seed pods, dried pine needles, and plucks early wildflower buds, tucking each specimen into a piece of folded paper. A leaf floats down from a tree. It floats back up. Lepidopterist is the word that comes to Pinch. Not butterfly or butterfly collector. Not even an idea of the insect. Just the word. As that butterfly adapted to resemble a leaf, he thinks, so I adapted to resemble a language teacher. Nobody could find the mysteriously vanished mobile, so Pinch treks down to the village phone box the place called. First to Birdie, so she may inform the rest of the family. Next, Connor Thomas, who agrees to write and circulate a news release whose purpose is to protect the Bavinsky clan from fact-checking reporters. Unfortunately, Connor fails to list all surviving offspring, causing the obituaries to cite Pinch as the only child. Bear's will appears to have read the same bulletin, for the entire estate goes to Pinch alone. He learns this shortly before the memorial service in Key Biscayne and informs only Birdie. She, who arranged the event to unite Dad's children for the first time, advises Pinch to play dumb. Telling everyone risks souring the memorial. A middle-aged schlub approaches them. This is your brother Jeff from Idaho, she tells Pinch. Jeff shakes hands, taking a name tag and a copy of the commemorative booklet, full of old photos of members of the Bear Bavinsky clan. In total, Dad fathered 17 children, it transpires, many of them in attendance, along with spouses and kids of their own. Pinch looks along the buffet table, nearly every stranger a blood relative.
Holy mackerel, someone exclaims. I got a nephew called Hannibal.
More uncomfortable facts emerge, too. Several of Bear's families overlapped, including a few wives. Three children have become painters, none with success. One is a struggling sculptor in Mexico. Another describes himself as a weaver and astrologer. Aside from Birdie, the only siblings whom Pinch has previously met are Widgeon and Owen. Widge never attempted to become Dad, but she did try to wed facsimiles, a series of shady charmers, which leads Pinch to wonder about her current hubby a small business owner who even resembles a younger bear. As for Owen, he was expelled from medical school decades back and is still living off the wealth of his aged mother, Carol, while working on a machine to cure diseases that Widge is convinced will earn her brother a Nobel. Among Owen's many boorish traits is that he ogles every female in attendance, yet refuses to speak with any. In various guests, Pinch discerns physical features of Bear. Several are of mixed races, and some speak no English, which prompts Pinch to hasten over and interpret. During the service, siblings offer remembrances, most of which follow a pattern, slightly funny, slightly awful, plucky smile, throwaway conclusion. But hey, that was Dad, right? To everyone who asks, Pinch diminishes his role in Bear's life. Yes, I sometimes had his phone number, but not always. Yes, I visited the French cottage, but it's hardly a villa, bit of a dump, freezing, full of insects, miles from anything. His relatives resent him, and they're not wrong to do so, for Pinch does consider his link to Dad more significant than theirs. He flashes to that final conversation with Bear. Dad chose me. Pinch's stomach drops, and his gaze falls too, fixed on the floor. All these strangers' shoes. Dad picked me. Queasily, he glances up, as if everyone could hear these thoughts.
To speak frankly, Charles, I cannot understand why you cremated the body without consulting anyone. I do not get how that was okay.
Sorry, Ivor, I didn't mean to upset anyone. I had to make a decision in the moment, and I was overwhelmed.
But sprinkling Bear's ashes in France, without even checking what I thought. Or what I thought?
Yeah, not cool, man. Not cool. That night, Pinch and Birdie meet at the hotel, escaping their siblings for a room service dinner of roast chicken and buttered spinach. The thing is, a nicer person, an easier person, would never have painted like that, Pinch argues. Birdie grimaces.
What bull! I know this is supposed to be a mourning period, Charlie, but I'm going to speak ill of Dad.
Why change the habit of a lifetime? He jokes.
You know, I only badmouth him to you, right?
I know, he assures her. I know you loved him.
I was so busy trying to win an argument with Daddy that I hardly even think I met him. What pisses me off is I can't help smiling sometimes when I think of him. God damn it. Mostly stuff from when I was little. He loved us when we were cute, right?
Not so much when we developed opinions. Luckily, that never happened in your case. She snorts with laughter.
There's this thing my mother always said about Dad, Pinch tells her. Imagine if your neighbor was Leonardo da Vinci, okay? Only he's an absolute pain in the neck. Complaining about noise, about the smell of your food, writing complaint letters that he slides under your door. He's awful every time you see him, whether you're sick, with a broken leg, doesn't matter. A nasty piece of work. But if you somehow knew what he was going to contribute to the world, how he treated you would seem minor. You wouldn't even mind, it's irrelevant.
Wait, are you seriously comparing Daddy to Leonardo da Vinci?
Of course not. There's no acquainting artists, but Bear was significant in his way. The bad behavior only matters as art history now.
Even if a man's important, she argues, he doesn't get to live by different rules.
Isn't society based on that premise?
Well then, I don't like society. And I didn't even like this thing today. Not that a memorial is for liking. But I keep wondering what it was even for. Certainly not closure. And I arranged the damn thing.
The purpose was to see you again, Bird, he says. Speaking of which, we need a toast. What do you say?
He raids the minibar, returning with a miniature bottle of bubbly. As her plastic cup froths over, she sips fast and raises it.
The worst, best artist I ever knew, she says, and to the son who takes over.
I'm not taking over, he scoffs.
Oh, you've taken over all right, she retorts, twinkling. The question is, Mr. Bavinsky, what becomes of you now?
1998. 61. Art in America magazine runs an appreciation on Bear's life and career. The article by Connor is written abominably, in Pinch's view, and rises to its preachy climax in the conclusion.
When meeting him a few years ago, Bavinsky spoke to me of surviving the talons of Clement Greenberg, who mythically accused him of being a reactionary. Later, Bavinsky even overcame the embrace of Life magazine, whose photo editor published an image of a naked sitter. Gee whiz, shocking. Well, shocking for 1948.
Throughout, Babinski painted those meaty miracles, as collector Mishmish Shapiro dubbed them in a BBC documentary on her phantasmagoric life. Even today, viewing Babinski behemoths such as Shoulder 3, 1954, is to ask oneself, by what alchemy can an artist paint a part of the body and depict more than the whole? Spread your eyes over 1961's Thigh and Hip, 12, pictured above right. No feeling persons can remain tearless when this painting is met with live. I use the word live advisedly because the body almost literally moves off the canvas, whose materiality is stripped more bare, one swears, than the unclothed model herself. It is not only because of his unique facture that discussions of a Babinski envelop such auratic resonance, referencing both pictorial empathy and a depth of portraiture achieved by few during our current century. Babinski bypassed the tentacles of pop art and op art, conceptualism, fluxus, and minimalism, and even bludgeoned away our fin de siècle anxiety, driving on through to the other side, untouched by the hype wafting from the coruscating distant shores of so-called art world. He was what only the greats have courage to be, yourself. As the marketplace grew more all-comprising, never did he fall into the maw of mammon. The only Babinskis to sell in years have been those on the secondary market, notwithstanding demand, which has turned from lukewarm to scalding since his untimely passing. Taking advantage of these sauna-like conditions, a private deal for Hans 9, 1952, just netted almost $500,000 for a noted Nebraska collector, sources close to the Petros Gallery say. Representatives of Babinski's one-time dealer declined to comment on the record, but at the time of his death, Eva Petros issued a statement describing the artist as an epoch in himself. Well said, for Babinski never wasted time opposing frivolity in the culture. His was the patience of ages. The road that he sailed renews every cynic's faith in authenticity and in beauty, however we choose to define that evading quarry. The screaming irony, of course, is that the so-called art world is today thirsting to know what Babinski was fevering at during those decades in the wilderness. And yes, the question arises, the wrong question, but a question of our times, just how much will those paintings be worth? A photocopy of this article circulates among the Babinski children, with a big money sale by a Nebraska collector highlighted in yellow. Siblings keep writing to Pinch, saying Dad erred by leaving everything to one son who doesn't even have kids of his own to support. You need a share, buddy. To pacify them, he promises to hear everyone's views. Some want the paintings themselves. Others insist the artworks be displayed in museums, as per their father's wishes. Several don't care and just want money. Complicating matters, none understands the market or art institutions. Can't you put them up for auction? Have museums buy them and we all make out good. Museums can buy at auction, Pinch answers, but mostly it's private buyers and you're subject to whoever bids highest, which isn't necessarily the museum of your choice. So we sell private to the museums we like, the top ones. But they have to want to buy, and you're reliant on dealers who have priorities of their own. Donate them? What you're perhaps imagining is that I'd hand the paintings over and they'd go up on the walls of MoMA, or wherever. But most of what major museums have is in storage. The likely outcome is I'd give away the paintings and they'd end up in crates. We have a lot to think about. How come you keep saying we? Because I want to include all of us in this. Then tell us what paintings you got. I still don't know, man. What's to stop you selling on the down low and never telling nobody? That's the last thing I do. I'm just asking for a bit of patience. Lots of people are involved here. Lots of people are getting old and dying with jack shit. Is that what Pops intended? Let's fucking sell and split it, bro. What Pinch fails to mention is that he's already approached a few museum directors, but nobody will consent to a restricted donation, not for an artist like Babinski, who would constitute a decent addition but is hardly the megastar to boost attendance figures. Moreover, everyone is wary about so many disgruntled Babinski children. Who wants to accept mid-market artworks when they could all end up in court? Most nights, upon Pinch's return from Utz, his answering machine light blinks with messages from relatives. Charles, an update on your plans. Call me back. But Pinch doesn't know his plans, with the inheritance or anything. He keeps circling around his final exchange with Bear when Dad implied that Pinch himself could have been a serious painter. That career is beyond him now. The gatekeepers of art are hardly yearning for a schoolteacher in his late 40s with little charisma, less hair, not a single show to his name. He tries to laugh, but his spirits plunge. This life has hardly been his own. There is a flip side, however. During his tube ride to work many mornings, ruminating over what in hell to do with his father's art, Finch clenches his eyes shut and remembers something. Vera Babinski liked how I paint. He imagines compositions for his next trip to France and ponders inviting someone to the studio. When she views his paintings, he'll consider the side of her face, anticipating her response. Let her like it. It's his tube stop. He leaps to his feet, beaming just to imagine. 62. Students stream from her classroom, chatting loudly, calling farewells back to Francesca. In the hallway, Finch stands aside, nodding greetings to a few familiar ex-pupils. When they've scattered, he approaches her classroom, glancing around to ensure he's alone. He takes a deep breath and raises his hand to knock, just as Francesca emerges. "Che colpa!" she exclaims, hand on her chest, and tucks back her hair, long and black in springy curls, her round face broadening when she smiles, causing him to do the same. Francesca, who is 29, finds herself in a peculiar position in London. She left Italy in frustration with the lack of opportunities and the incivility, but is now employed not merely to teach the Italian language, but to embody British fantasies about a carefree nation she never knew. In private, she is cutting about the follies of Utz, which allows Pinch to be the same. They've grown friendly, perhaps even fond of each other, especially since Salvatore quit. Everyone assumed that Pinch would take over as the Italian department chief, but the promotion went to Francesca. Briefly, this stung, but he accepted her suitability, bright, popular, organized. Also, Pinch hasn't stepped foot in Italy since his teens, though he sometimes claims otherwise to students. His sense of modern Italy derives from reading La Repubblica most days, which enables him to speak journalese about bribery scandals in Milan or the burlesque of Berlusconi, though he remains prone to comically outdated slang which entertains Francesca immensely. "Scusa, perdonami," he responds for having startled Francesca, and touches her arm in apology, amazed that he's doing so. Pinch commands himself to channel Dad, chin up, a wink. For weeks he's wanted to make an advance. Alone at Bear's cottage, dealing with the French bureaucratic consequences of death, Pinch contemplated her daily, seeing himself driving Francesca around the area, explaining the local language groups, showing her the market, providing tasting boards of local cheeses, matching them with local wines, of which I know a tad too much, he joked, on his own in the car. And walking into the woods, he wondered whether, as a botanist, she could give a proper tour of his land. "She'll stay on the cottage, and I'll take the studio. Unless... But each morning back at home in London, the bathroom mirror has dissuaded him. He's so much older than her. Chubby, bald, frumpy. So today, he forewent his reflection, which explains the mussed hair and bad shave. The pretext for standing in her classroom door this evening is a long-standing promise. Francesca is moving into a larger office, that of the departed Salvatore. Pinch pledged to help her move her furniture, and he has kidded about lifting dumbbells to prepare. She keeps demurring, worrying that it would be too heavy. Perhaps the janitor should do it. "I will not be deterred, Frau," he tells her now, and marches towards her old office where he stands before the bookcase, estimating dimensions with his arms. "We should take down the books first, no?" she notes. Grinningly, Pinch waves us away. He's all bravado tonight, not least because of something amusing he'll show her, a dried lump of paper in his pocket. At the cottage, he picked wild flower buds to show her, folding them into a sketchbook page, on which he jotted questions as a conversation starter. Once home, he stupidly laundered those trousers, flowers and all. He'll show her the lump and result, adding, as if in passing, "You have to come see the place yourself. It's amazing. What do you think?" And now he smirks at her bookcase. "Not too hard for a tough guy like me." He rolls up his sleeves, jokingly flexing an aging bicep. "Don't hurt yourself, Mr. Schwarzenegger," she says, grinning, taking a step closer. He meets her gaze. Switching to English, he says, "I've been busting to do this," and leans in to kiss her. "Oh, Dio!" she cries, recoiling as if he were contagious. She hooks the thick curls behind her ear, unable to look at him, adjusting a framed picture of a man on one of the shelves. "I'm sorry, Charles. I'm engaged." "What? Oh, you completely misunderstood, he insists, ridiculously, throat flushing crimson. I was reaching past you to take down some of the dictionaries. After all, you're far too tall for me to kiss. I couldn't reach, even if I wanted to.
Don't worry about it.
No, I wasn't worrying, just as a point of fact. He gives a nervous cough. I'm here to move furniture.
Forget that, Charles. The janitor will do it. Really, thank you, though.
She fills a banker's box with papers as a way to conclude this excruciating exchange. Isn't even heavy, he says, legs apart, grasping one side of the bookcase, then the other. As if to tighten his grip, he shifts about, unsure how to give up.
Charles, it's much too heavy with the book still in. I'm not joking.
Oh, it's not even full. He tries again, vein bulging in his forehead. I'm going to get this. He holds his breath, straining, grunting, and slaps both hands underneath the shelf for leverage.
That's not stable.
But he is lifting it. He's managing. Until the shelf flies up, and volumes of the Encyclopedia Zanichelli crash down, bashing into him, her desk, the floor. She squeals, for the entire shelving system is coming apart. A vase falls, smashing on the carpet, glass shards everywhere, water seeping from downed irises. Dictionaries on the higher shelves shower down. Pinch raises one arm to sustain the falling bookcase, the other to protect himself, hard covers cascading onto him.
Charles, stop, please!
Finally, to save himself, he darts away, inadvertently barging her into the hallway, the shelving clattering down behind them, her possessions smashing onto the floor, an office wrecked in seconds. He lands on his knees, and pain shoots from his spine. He clasps the sweat-soaked back of his shirt. He cannot breathe. Above him, Francesca holds her breast, which she inadvertently elbowed. She hurries into the office to collect the smashed photo of her fiancé. Pinch tries to stand, but the back pain knocks him down again.
Charles, I think you must go, she says in English. Okay, I must clean.
He tries to rise, another bolt of agony. Sorry, he says, wincing. I can't move. Something with my back. I'm in serious pain. She helps him to his feet, as if he were a senior citizen. Fighting down a scream, he shuffles out, insisting that he's better now, just fine, though is inwardly obliterated by nerve damage, so agonizing as to erase her voice, almost erase his shame. At the end of the corridor, he turns, is out of view, and lowers himself, holding his breath until he lies on the coffee-stained carpet, blinking up at white fluorescent. He holds still, praying nobody comes. Minutes later, he overhears Francesca speaking with muted horror into her desk phone, then locking up her office for the night and leaving. A half hour later, footsteps approach. Ching stands above him. They've not spoken much of late. Pinch has been dealing with his father's death, she with the demise of her marriage. With much difficulty, she helps him to stand, then leads Pinch outside to flag down a black cab. She insists on accompanying him home. Neither speaks during the ride.
We are both working late again, she says, finally, on the fold-down seat opposite him. We are the outcasts.
He reaches over to shake her hand, but the movement tweaks his spine again. He grips her fingers.
Almost home, she tells him.
Ching offers to help him inside, but he declines, claiming that the drive did him good. Alone, he inches up the entrance steps, struggles for the house key in a tight pocket, and makes it inside his flat, the dogs snuffling his trouser legs. He can't even crouch to pat them. He stands there, cringing to recall an hour ago.
So pathetic. Still trying at this age, like the last middle-aged man on the dance floor. That, he decides, was my final attempt. Enough. Enough of other people. All I need is my cottage. Disappear there. Stay within the borders of a canvas. That is my company.
Old Age. Oil on canvas, 64 by 150 inches. Courtesy of the Bavinsky Estate. 63. Afternoon tutorials start in 72 minutes, but Pinch remains in bed. Exerting his stomach muscles, he wills himself upward, but only howls. The torture originates in his spinal column, but people are waiting. He cannot stay here.
Get up!
With a shriek, he forces himself vertical and punches the bedside table, except that hurts too. Pulse racing, he is rendered mindless in primal distress. He holds still, tries to catch a breath, and proceeds to the nightmare of dressing. His walk to the tube station is normally 8 minutes. Today, he needs almost 40. Each footstep an act of self-harm. Pedestrians push past, grumbling, taking him for a daytime drunk. On the train platform, he tenses his muscles, unable to even wipe the perspiration that rolls down his bald pate, halting in an eyebrow, then slithers ticklishly down the bridge of his nose. The train doors open. Crowds shove in all directions. He edges inside, clasps a pole with both hands, the metal slippery under his grip. The carriage lurches forward. He takes strangulated gasps at each bump. Pinch expected his pain to recede when he got active, but he shouldn't have travelled.
I need a doctor.
While in line at the pharmacy, he swallows 4 ibuprofens, dry. Before the first tutorial, he takes 4 more. They numb him only slightly. Alarm messages still arrowing to his brain.
Everything all right, Mr. Bevinsky?
Yes, Monique.
Do you have a fever or something?
She asks, shifting her chair away from Pinch, who is dripping.
No, I'm fine. Cerchiamo di parlare in italiano, d'accordo?
He makes it through the day and home, where Harold and Tony leap around his ankles, needing dinner. He can't stoop to upturn the can of dog food into their bowls. Sorry. Later. Breathing with as little expansion of his lungs as possible, he unbuttons his drenched shirt. His shoulder muscles are a solid block, so taut that his neck shivers. After an hour-long effort and many yelps, he is lying on his bed. By dawn, Pinch has not slept and is bursting to pee. This is unlike yesterday, when movement was only bearable. Today, he seems to have lost executive control, pain overriding volition.
I'm stuck,
he mumbles, picturing an insect pinned to a board.
I am the source of these thoughts. Why am I saying them aloud?
Stop that.
His words emerge with a gust of breath, lowering his ribcage, causing fresh violence to his spine. Shivering, he inhales, smelling his own sweat.
Not yet 50 and I'll need a wheelchair.
He moves his eyes to the left, right, up, down.
Locked-in syndrome, now that would be suffering. This is not. Come on. Get up.
Failing, he screams out. The cordless phone is too far on his bedside table, but if someone calls him, he could lunge in that direction, perhaps knock the phone off its base, which will connect the call, then shout for all he's worth. The day passes. Nobody phones.
The human bladder is like a balloon, he reassures himself. Can it explode like a balloon?
Prior to the invention of aluminum tubes, he says to distract himself, artists kept paint in pig bladders. Oh, screw it. He pees on himself. The dogs are seated at the base of his bed, looking quizzically upward. He hears only their panting. If nobody saves me, and you're hungry, boys, get stuck in, he chuckles, trying to suppress it. Only after I've snuffed it. Agreed, boys? And the phone rings. Whimpering, he jabs towards it, shoving the bedside table. The phone wobbles, it teeters, and it plunges from sight onto the carpet. He shouts his predicament, does so thrice, wondering who hears.
Please don't be a telemarketer.
2 hours later, someone is fiddling with a lock to his front door. He recognizes the voice of Ching and his landlord, a bizarre mix of unrelated parts of his life. Immediately, he downgrades his fear from existential to social.
Are my trousers stained? Will they smell urine?
His landlord grimaces. Ching appears unbothered. She takes control, calls the ambulance, demanding that they drug him before attempting a move. She is formidable.
Oh, right,
Pinch mutters, disappearing into the fog of a serious painkiller.
You've studied medicine once.
He needs only a day in the ward. The doctor prescribes analgesics and muscle relaxants, and speaks of a possible operation. Edgily, Pinch explains that he drives long distances, must visit France regularly, can't be trapped here. Listen to your back, the doctor says. Once home, he finds himself on that same bed. He lies in a drugged torpor, replaying the humiliation in Francesca's office, squeezing his eyes shut to blacken the event, which runs on a loop. Daily, Ching stops by to walk and feed the dogs, and to pick up his groceries and tidy. She expects no gratitude, and ignores it when offered. Once, Pinch is in a bleak mood and snaps at her, deploring himself afterwards. The next day she returns, seemingly unbothered, claiming to have nothing better to do after work. But she does have another concern. Salvatore is demanding a big settlement in the divorce, claiming she forced him out at Utz, which is nonsense. He's pushing for her to sell their marital home and pay him a lump sum, probably so he doesn't have to work any time soon. Xing bought that place with her own money and resides there today. She'd be cast from her own house.
I hope you don't mind me saying this, Xing, but your husband disgusts me.
Thank you.
He doesn't even speak Italian. Did you know that? It appalls me how few of our colleagues take languages seriously. I know hardly anybody else who takes advantage of the free classes. I'm doing beginner French. We're almost the only ones. Nowadays, he adds bitterly, the main reason people get hired at Utz is they're good-looking.
It is lucky, Xing comments, that they do not have this policy when we apply. He laughs and winces.
Ah, don't be funny, please.
But he finds very few causes of amusement. His infirmity drags on. Each night he lies rigid in bed in a clutch of pain.
Do you need me to come over there?
Marsden asks, calling from Toronto.
I'm fine. Could you do with something to distract yourself? Your dad said you painted before. Couldn't you get back to that?
Marsden asks.
I could send you a set of pastels or watercolors. Let me. You should, Charles. You should do this.
Pinch boils at the suggestion, which he takes as patronizing, an allusion to what Bear said during their final exchange. Pinch wants to retort that he's not some pitiful amateur. A work of mine once hung in Nebraska, of all places. But in his current state, to characterize himself as a painter would be absurd. Nothing sadder than those who declare themselves artists when not a soul cares what they create. Effort and humiliation feel so close.
You're trying to cheer me up. You're trying to be kind. I know, Mars, but it's having the opposite effect. Actually, I should probably go.
And the phone rings minutes later. Pinch snatches it up, needing to redo that conversation. But it's a disgruntled sibling, pressing him for details about the will. Pinch ends the call in haste, turns off the ringer, lowers the volume on the answering machine to zero. In coming weeks, the answering machine tape clicks on at all hours. He is besieged by those savages. He pictures them breaking into his cottage, bashing down the door to the studio, pillaging everything, smashing Natalie's pottery. In the shadows of his bedroom, Utz students are snickering as he enters the classroom, and fellow teachers are gossiping. He threw himself at Francesca. Revolting, right? He turns on the bed, punishing himself by talking his back, immediately repenting, begging his pillow, surrendering anything. Let them slice me apart. Just stop this. The orthopedic surgeon remains so cautious, telling him to wait and see. Eventually, Pinch does improve slightly, and is able to distract himself by reading his advanced Latin textbook from university, and by leafing through the daily papers, La Repubblica, Die Zeit, Le Monde, El País, which Xing collects from a local newsagent. When Tony falls ill, in solidarity with me, Pinch says, stroking him, Xing transports the dog to the veterinary clinic. He never returns. Harold cannot manage without his lifelong ally. The animal sleeps all day and doesn't last till year's end. Pinch wasn't present to comfort either of his dogs when they were put down. He won't forgive himself for that. He cannot stop imagining them, each there alone, looking around for him. Eyes brimming, he lies on the living room floor, studying the plaster medallion on his ceiling. He distracts himself by eavesdropping on the married couple who moved into the apartment below and used to have intrusively loud sex until it was their newborn making the late-night screams. Pinch still hasn't figured out which language that family speaks. Someday he hopes to meet them and to say hello to their little kid, whose feeding times and sleep times he knows through the walls. One morning he ventures outside for a slug, slow shuffle around the block. When returning to his building, the woman from the apartment below is struggling to hoist her pram up the stairs. Pinch stands there, so wanting to help, explaining at length about his back.
It is not necessary, she says with a brisk smile.
Face red as a tomato, a sobbing baby needing milk, not this chatterbox neighbor. She shoulders the building door open. It slams behind her. She calls out from inside.
Sorry, no free hands.
Sometimes Pinch conducts tutorials at his home for long-time students, among them an aging ex-boxer who works for the London Underground and is studying Italian to keep alert as retirement nears, and a thick-eyebrowed Catholic sister aiming to make the case for nuns' rights at the Vatican, and a stockbroker who, having survived a brain tumor, is learning every Lorenzo da Ponte opera libretto. Ching schedules the tutorials on Pinch's behalf, intending to raise his spirits, but they demoralize him. At Utz, his status derived from mastery in the eyes of his pupils. When they view his shabby flat, witness him moving around like a man of 90, he senses himself shriveling in their perception. At his next meeting with the surgeon, she finds enough progress to rule out an operation. You will always have pain, but it can be managed. Who doesn't have a war wound or two at your age? Not sure it qualifies as a war wound, he says, buttoning his shirt. I got this from running from a falling dictionary. When a nurse signs him up for a hearing test, as mandated for those his age, the results are worse than average. Nothing to worry about, she says. Nothing for you to worry about, he responds lightly. They're not your ears. If one faculty is deteriorating, others must be in equal decline. His body is decomposing from the inside. He keeps seeing the image of an apple rotting within its skin. He looks at the cordless phone, intending to call Marsden. They haven't spoken often since what happened at the cottage. But Pinch longs for that voice now. He picks up the phone, but there is no dial tone. Somebody is already on the line. He forgot the ringer was off. It's one of his siblings' lawyers. I haven't sold any of the paintings. Stop contacting me. Excuse me, Mr. Bavinsky, sir. According to legal records, there was indeed a bill of sale, from your name to the name of a Mr. Dwyer of Omaha, occurring back in... Pinch slams the phone onto its base, the impact reverberating through him. Widgeon, too, is hounding him with requests for money to expand her business selling handmade greeting cards and candles online, and Birdie asks in a letter if something will go to her kids, noting that Bear never even bothered to meet them. What I think, Marsden contends when they speak, is just dump all the paintings on the market. Bear himself was doing an inventory, right? Perhaps he was thinking of selling. Why are you pushing me, Morris? Because I can't stand that you feel obligated to him. Sorry, it's not my business, but I hate it. Pinch is ashamed to admit that he's clinging to these paintings. If he cedes control, what has he got? Everything feels like more than he can manage, from washing himself to the 1,000 phone messages to opening mail. He's on disability leave, but the school won't tolerate this indefinitely. He dreads returning there. Everyone at Utz has become so young, and they're all more accomplished than he. His students talk casually of stock options and postings abroad. They brag of weekend getaways to Prague and check flashy Motorola flip phones. Previously, he always thought, none of this matters. In secret, I'm an artist. But away from the cottage for so long, he can't understand why he ever went. His attempts at art seem the height of futility. As a boy, in Rome, he once calculated that when the year 2000 arrived, he'd be half a century old. Thankfully, he never pictured his true millennial New Year's Eve, fireworks fizzing outside, the muffled countdown of revelers in adjacent flats, his murderous rage at them, at everyone, even Marsden. Why, Pinch wonders, have I become so angry? Because of the pain? There are pharmaceuticals involved, too. Was I always this way, detesting those who outstripped me, at school, in university, in painting? He thinks of Temple Butterfield, that great artist. I'm so petty, hating people who don't even think of me. The truth is that I have achieved what I deserve. 64. The new century begins with fanfare. The world marching towards ever more democracy, economies growing infinitely, the internet guaranteeing better versions of everything. On a distant sideline, Pinch observes, buried under misery, until something unexpected happens. He wakes with almost no pain. Gingerly, and withholding belief, Pinch steps around the flat, testing this resurrected body, repressing any expectations, until they culminate in a sob of joy and a defiant stamp on the ground, only to chastise himself for forgetting his neighbors and their sleeping baby. Still, this is amazing. Is it real? Will it stay? He parts the curtains, peeking at dawn. He could just go outside, but it's too early. He's become fearful of hoodlums, having no ability to protect himself. Now I'd punch those druggies in the nose. He tries to calm down, but cannot stop this jittery high. The pain will come back. Be careful. Instead, he kicks a pile of unopened letters, months' worth, and halts to see familiar handwriting among the scattered envelopes. He stoops, atrophied thighs shaking, and flops onto his backside. He rips open the letter, finding condolences about his father from Cilla Barrows. She found him through Marsden, and is saying, or rather, she said, this is from ages back, how much she has come to admire Bear's work, and that she shudders to recall her callow self in France. She inserts a gloss of her past quarter century, publishing books, teaching, raising a family. "I still owe you money for our European vacation," she writes. "How much was my share?" On Natalie's old red Olivetti, Pinch types a response, with the warmest greetings and a jokey summary of his own life, adding the email address that the Utz school recently forced on everyone. P.S. Absolutely no need to pay me back. After breakfast, he ambles at a slow but acceptable pace to the Earl's Court post office. Who was ever more elated to stand in an 11-person queue? He chats to the adorable Jamaican granny working at the counter, Pinch gabbing away, as he's seen others do. How angry that used to make him. Now he can gripe about his back and his doctor. "Well," he says at his leisure, "must be off, my darling." Everything has an exclamation point today. Tattering to himself all the way home, he recalls Natalie's manic spells, when she bounded around the art studio in Rome and worked on pottery through the night. He always cautioned her to slow down. "Oh, enjoy your highs," he tells her now. "Why didn't I let you? Am I older now than you were? God, I think I am." He ponders Bear, too. To succeed as an artist demands such a rare confluence of personality, talent, of luck, all bundled into a single lifespan. What a person Dad was. Pinch decides that perhaps he himself had ability too, but this was insufficient. He lacked the personality. The art world was always beyond him. For the first time, he accepts this. And he longs to tell someone of his painless state. After hesitating, he phones Ching. Might she come out for a drink? The pint of lager looks huge on the pub table before her. He buys Ching a packet of prawn cocktail crisps and gobbles them himself, laughing to notice he has done so. He rises to buy more. "Look, I can get up and down." When she tells of putting her house on the market to satisfy Salvatore's greed, Pinch becomes indignant. "That's terrible. You know, I should just buy the house," he says. "Listen, what if we did a deal privately? You'd save, I'd get a mortgage, pay you a good price, and you could pay off that idiot without losing your home. I'd actually like to own property in London." Slough. "Well, that's almost London. My house is very cold, Charles." "I specialize in cold houses." Thinking of the French cottage, he smiles. The absence of that place is what made him crumple this past year, perhaps as much as the pain itself. And he can return there now. "Look, I could rent your house back to you so you'd get to stay as long as you liked. It's too big for me alone." "Then I take a wing. Why not? I need to move. I associate my place with Harold and Tony. I'd welcome a change." Suddenly, he doubts his own stream of promises. Does he, a man in his 50s, want a housemate? Does he want it to be Ching? Then again, if she speaks Mandarin around the house, that'd be useful. Does free language tutelage justify the purchase of a house? He's distracted again, grinning about that letter from Barrows. Nostalgia overcomes him. He claps his hand upon Jing's and gives a hopeful squeeze. 65. When fully sober, Pinch prefers to simply lend Ching £10,000 to pay off her grasping ex-husband, rather than buying a charmless house in Slough. But there is fallout from his high that night. He left a tipsy voicemail for his landlord, giving notice, quite rudely too. Sheepishly, Pinch called back, but his flat had already been promised to someone else. Until he finds a place, Pinch must lodge in a spare room at Ching's house. On his first day back at Utz, he and she take the train into central London together. Francesca greets him warmly, explaining that she had to hire another Italian teacher in his absence. "Don't look so worried. You still have the same number of hours." "Yes, great." He lowers his head. "Thanks." He sits at his office computer, struggling to learn the new Utz software suite, when he discovers a pleasant surprise, an email from Barrows, who is insisting on a restitution for their long-ago trip to France, estimating her debt at $2,000. "This is a ludicrous sum," he emails back, warning her not to send a penny. "If she does, I'll never buy another of her books." Priscilla Barrows, pjbarrows@princeton.edu, wrote, "Charles, you read my books? Apologies. I'm boring the hell out of you, not to mention my six other readers. CB." Charles Bavinsky. Charles Bavinsky at utzlearning.com wrote, "Dear Barrows, you have nothing to apologize for. I do buy your books, but confess that I've started none. Yours sincerely, Charles." Priscilla Barrows. "Ouch! How come?" CB. Charles Bavinsky. "I was afraid that I might be mentioned. I'm only joking. Yours, Charles." Priscilla Barrows. "Ha!" Smiley face. "You have a saying at Princeton. Have I read it? I haven't even taught it. My books are basically cultural takedowns in which I linger over phrases like subversive sociality. Avoid. Avoid!" Charles Bavinsky. "You used a smiling face. I don't know how to do that on my machine. If your fellow academics knew that you put smiling faces in your letters, you would be a pariah. P.S. How do you do smiling faces?" Priscilla Barrows. "They're smiley faces, not smiling." Frowny face. "I refer you to the essay on email etiquette in my last book, but seriously, which you bought and wisely failed to read. And no, I'm not telling you how to do smiley faces. You'd only abuse the privilege. Love, Barrows." In less than 3 weeks, their email correspondence has surpassed the ease of communication they achieved during nearly a year of dating. So much easier to connect when you cannot touch. Finally, he deals with his clogged answering machine, a full 90-minute audio tape. To his alarm, he missed a number of calls months ago from Marsden, who was worried about the protracted silence. But most messages are from irked relatives or attorneys. Early in the tape, they are only menacing. As the messages progress, the same voices issue dated cautions. They're questioning the will, impugning his behavior, demanding to see what he possesses. This mess is closing in. In the months ahead, Finch consults with lawyers at length, before conceding that he might have to abandon these paintings or face bankruptcy from legal fees. Another fear is that the French authorities will discover that he inherited paintings in their territory, which could land him in tax hell. It would perhaps also trigger tax claims in America and Britain. Nope, there's no way to retain the art, yet he can't accept handing it over. When emailing with Barrows in recent months, he often lampooned his small life as a language teacher. He did so with genuine amusement because he's demonstrably something more, in charge of serious artworks, of a foreign property, of the Bear Bavinsky legacy. All that makes him almost important, and they say he must surrender that. 2002. 66. During the next school holiday, Pinch drives too fast through France. The highway lane stripes whipping underneath as he whooshes past gas station turnoffs and countryside. Once in the studio, he contemplates his father's paintings. 26 life stills that Bear hid here and that Pinch inherited. He passes 2 weeks alone, occasionally dashing out to buy food and supplies. On his last day, he hikes down to the village payphone to call New York. "I don't suppose you could fly out here in a few months," he says into a crackly line. On the agreed date, Pinch returns once more to the cottage and waits, finally watching a Hyundai Getz struggling up the driveway, engine coughing, the tires spitting pebbles. The handbrake cranks, and out steps Connor Thomas in a pink polo shirt with collar popped, cargo shorts, Teva sandals. "Oh, wow, I'm actually here," he says, looking around. Pinch leads his guest to the kitchen, where a life still rests against a table leg. Another, even larger life still is flat on the table top. A third rests against the wall. "Nobody else has seen these, Connor. Nobody except Dad, me, and now you. What do you think?" Eyes bugging, hands clasped behind him, Connor gapes, neck straining like a chained dog. "I had so hoped it'd be this." He leaps from one life still to another. "Dare I ask, Charles, are there more?" Pinch hesitates, then nods, prompting a squeak from Connor, whose attention returns to the art. He crab-walks the length of the table, leans towards a canvas for close inspection, clutching his thighs. "Ah, like real ah. And Bear's studio is here, right? Can I peek?" "Let's hold off on that." "Right, totally. I'm getting ahead of myself. Wow, I could seriously faint." For show, he gulps a few breaths of air and fans himself with his hand, then fixes on Pinch. "Perhaps I'm speaking out of turn here, but aren't you crazy to keep these here? It must get damp and cold, no? There could be a fire, a theft, or anything.
This is where Dad always kept them. The safest place in the world. Nobody even knows where this place is.
Except me, now. Something goes missing, and you can send a gendarme to hunt me down.
For a chilling instant, Pinch hears his father barking at Marsden to get the cops up here. Then Pinch is back, smiling at his guest, waiting for Connor to detect the obvious flaws in these three paintings, all of them copies that he produced during his last visit. When the man figures it out, Pinch will confess to the prank and bring out the authentic Bavinskys, which they can compare for amusement, and, with a presumed flattery, Connor will offer his host. But, amusingly, the supposed Bavinsky expert finds nothing untowards, bubbling with worshipful remarks, each of which is a firework of elation inside Pinch. He smooths over a few long strands of hair, readying his confession.
Connor. Charles, I need to thank you for selecting me. He bows with a hand-twirling flourish. These paintings are unbelievable.
I was going to say something. Connor is not listening, beguiled by replicas.
I was going to tell you.
Pinch stops. It'd make Connor look foolish to expose him suddenly like this. Do it delicately, later. For now, Pinch can't help basking.
You know, I just realized the time. They're pretty late for this part of the world. If we're going to eat tonight, we should find a restaurant. Who needs food when my eyes are feasting on these?
Pinch smiles, feeling like a twit for his jubilation.
He drives Connor to Vernet-les-Bains, promising the best restaurant anywhere around, although Pinch has never eaten out when visiting the cottage.
The place turns out to be empty, with an unctuous manager who presses on them every piece of fish and game in urgent need of dispatch from the kitchen.
Those pictures are in my head right now, Connor remarks, stabbing at his rabbit stew.
Pinch fills their glasses again from a carafe of Côte de Roussillon, taking a long sip to ready for his confession. Connor holds up his glass, gazing at the ruby liquid as if art itself sloshed around in there.
I'm seeing them everywhere I look.
He clinks with Pinch, who takes another bracing gulp. Before we go into further discussion of what you saw today, Connor, I need to mention something. There's a larger reason I invited you out here, he says.
I'm intrigued.
Well, I wanted to propose something, a bit more than you're just writing one article.
Don't keep me hanging.
Connor, I'd like you to consider writing a book on Bear Bavinsky, the official biography. I could give you exclusive access to all there is. Everything. Pinch dips a nub of baguette into his glass. What say you?
Emphatically, yes.
Pinch swallows the winey bread, swipes a napkin across his lips, sits higher. My dad had mixed feelings about putting his work out there, and he's not around to state a preference today. So I need for us, not just me, but you too, to take on that mantle. Essentially, what I'm saying is, I want to invite you to work alongside me on this.
I am speechless.
Tomorrow, I'm going to show you all the life stills that Bear left me. And here's the tough part. They will not be together again. Probably ever. Hard to say, but I'm giving them away. All of them. Bear's other children do deserve something.
Hold your horses, Charles. Is this what Bear wanted? These works should be in major collections. That's what he always said.
I know what he said, Pinch replies, a little testy. You tell me the alternative, then. Pinch sees his father shouting at him outside the cottage, jabbing a finger at him, saying, "You work for me!" And Pinch recalls phone conversations during university, when Bear dangled the prospect of collaborating, always in the service of his art.
But it's mine now. You work for me, Dad. Without meaning to, you ended up working entirely for me.
Pinch taps his fork against a serpent of entrecote fat curled across his plate. What am I supposed to do? They're relentless, my family.
Do you have to give in?
Off the record, Connor. There's no way for me to hold on to these. I'll lose them anyway if I fight this.
Why not donate them to the French state before anyone can stop you? Get them displayed somewhere edgy.
Who can guarantee the French state wants them? Once I declare these works, they'll tax the hell out of them and I'll lose all leverage. No, my plan is this. You study them over the next few days. Gradually, quietly, I drive them to London in coming months. Probably it violates export license rules, but I won't be profiting personally. Once I get them all home, a clever lawyer can reinterpret Dad's will so every Bavinsky child gets something. Tax liability then becomes the concern of each individual. I realize that means most of them will sell and the paintings will be lost to the wind. I don't love knowing that,
but if you can think of an alternative, say so.
I find this heartbreaking. Also, what it must be doing to you.
Pinch nods, sadly, stroking the tablecloth, breadcrumbs jumping. All I can do is encourage them to sell to reputable collectors.